Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET for DSL Extreme.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, August 25th, 2007, on the premier radio networks, including XM Channel 152 and many of the best talk stations in the nation. This is show 381. Enjoy. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. 8888 Ask Leo, and I'm ready to talk tech with you today. Right here. Are you ready to talk with me? 8888 Ask Leo. That could be anything. When I say tech, I mean anything having to do with a computer or the internet. Of course, we have to talk about that. But also, I want to make sure you understand it's not just that. It's cell phones and camcorders. It's the internet, Web 2.0. I said the internet. Well, it's worth saying twice. It's home theater. If you want to talk about it, I'm ready to talk about it with you. 888-827-5536. 888-827-5536. We'll get to the phones in just a second. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater expert's coming up in just a bit. But let's get right now to the big story of the week. The shocker. Well, maybe not a shocker. The iPhone has been unlocked. Now, wait a minute before you say, I don't care. I'm not interested. I don't want to know about the iPhone. This is more than just an iPhone story. It's kind of a morality tale for people who think they can prevent users from doing what they want. How about that? How about that for making it a big story? So here's the deal, and you know this probably by now. June 29th, Apple sells its first iPod with a phone built in. They call it the iPhone. They sell 1 million in the first few weeks. Very exciting for people who are Mac aficionados, iPod aficionados, or who just want to see what can be done with a portable phone slash internet device slash media device. But there's one little catch. Apple does a deal with AT&T, a very good deal for Apple, I have to point out. A 5-year exclusive to AT&T, saying, you know, only AT&T will be able to offer this phone for the next 5 years. If you want to use this phone, if you want to even use it as an iPod, you have to set up an account with AT&T. This is a big deal for Apple because AT&T, apparently, and we don't have absolute confirmation of this, but it seems to be pretty accepted wisdom. AT&T said you can keep all the profit from the iPhone, which many estimate to be as much as half, $300 or more. Keep all the profit of the iPhone, and we're going to give you a cut of all the phone services. So, you know, you have to make a 2-year deal with AT&T when you buy an iPhone. It's a minimum of $60 a month. If you travel overseas, AT&T will really rake you over the coals. I know people who have 2,000, friend of mine who does the show notes for me, Alex Goucher, high school student, went to Ireland for a couple of weeks with his iPhone, wasn't paying attention, just used his iPhone as he would normally at home, had a $2,000 bill, but that's nothing. I know people who have $12,000 international roaming data fees on their iPhone. This because AT&T does not offer the same international roaming plans on the iPhone it offers on other phones. Is that Apple? Is that AT&T? I don't know. But let's put it this way. The greed apparent from both Apple and AT&T has made a few people a little angry. And I think this is the real story. You don't want to get your users angry. You don't want to offer them, dangle in front of them something they really want, really cool, really neat, and then say you can't have it unless you sign up for 2 years with AT&T. So what'd they do? They hacked it. They've unlocked it. And there are now at least three ways to use an iPhone without using AT&T. undermining both AT&T and Apple, don't forget, because Apple gets a big portion of that revenue. We don't know how big, but some money. So undermines both Apple and AT&T. The first way to do it, and I've already talked to people who've done this, and it's a little more complicated, is getting something called a turbo SIM. It's a special kind of SIM you can order online, and you have to have, you know, some special equipment and make that SIM work with your iPhone, modify it to work with your iPhone. I'm not sure of the details on this. Somebody can call me and tell me. I'd love to know about it. Put it in the iPhone and all of a sudden use it. I've talked to somebody who's using their iPhone in Canada completely, well, I want to say completely legally. We'll get to that in a second, but as if it's a regular phone on the Rogers network. Still works as an iPod, still able to sync it, put stuff on it. Can't update it, I think. I think at that point you have to say, I'm not going to update it anymore because, well, any update could break this system. But that's a little complicated for people, right? That's a little much. Well, all right. How about this? Do it completely in software. Now, you might have heard about unlocked phones. I mean, they've been around for a while. Any GSM phone, and that means AT&T or T-Mobile in the U.S. and many, many, most carriers, in fact, around the world. Any GSM phone can be unlocked. Another SIM card from another company can be put into it, and you can use it with a different company. You could buy a... I use an unlocked phone, for instance, with T-Mobile. I bought a Nokia N95 completely legally, put my T-Mobile SIM card, that little card in it, and all of a sudden it's my phone. And now that's completely legal. Where it gets a little sticky is where you sign up with a one carrier. Say you sign up with T-Mobile. Normally that phone is locked down, can only work on the T-Mobile network. You then unlock it, and there are usually ways to do this on the keypad, actually. You unlock it, sometimes with hardware and sometimes with software. You unlock it. Now it's unlocked. Now I can use it with AT&T. And now that gets a little sketch because presumably T-Mobile subsidized the phone and they have a contract with you and you're kind of violating that terms of use deal. Now, AT&T, remember, is not subsidizing the iPhone, so I don't think people feel too guilty about that. I've talked to people who've used this new unique phones system, and they say it works. There's two systems out there. Now, unique phones say they're going to go online today. They say between noon and 2 Eastern time. I should check right now, because that's like right now. They're gonna go live with a downloadable service. You could unlock your iPhone. It'll be, they say, between $20 and $50. iPhoneunlocking.com. Is it live yet? Let me check. I should have checked. I forgot. It's now. They're supposed to go live. iPhoneunlocking.com. No, not yet. You have to have an invite code. 450,000 people have registered for that invite code. You know, we'll see if they go live when they say they will. But I have talked to Ryan Blockett and Gadget, who says he's seen this thing work. I don't know if it's this one or the other one. I think it's the other one. He's seen it work. It does, in fact, unlock the iPhone. You're able to use iTunes with it. You're able to use it as an iPod as well as a phone with T-Mobile in the U.S. Another one is iPhonesIamFree.com. iPhonesIamFree.com. And they've also come up with a software unlock. I think that's the, in fact, as a matter of fact, I think that's the one Ryan has used. Now, neither of these have I used or have I seen used, but I have been told they work well. And I've also talked to somebody who's used the hardware on Hack. So now here's a question. Is it legal to do this? You can do it. You could technically do it. I'm not sure, frankly, if you'll be... able to continue to do it if you unlock it. It's possible that Apple could push something down through iTunes that would break it. By the way, unique iPhones now, this is an update that just happened about an hour ago. AT&T's lawyers. Oops. AT&T's lawyers have called them. And that's why it's not live yet. Now, will AT&T's lawyers call you is the question. Well, technically it is illegal, or maybe not. Know Your Rights is an article on Engadget. I'll put this in the show notes at techguylabs.com. The issue is the DMCA. Once again, yeah, our favorite law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which says you cannot circumvent copy protection or access controls. Now, it is a circumvention. It is technically, according to this lawyer who's writing for Engadget, it is technically it's Nilay Patel, who's a copyright attorney, technically a violation of the DMCA, but there are lots of maybes, buts. And in some cases, the Copyright Office has said it's okay. Remember, the FCC has ruled it's okay to unlock other phones, to use them unlocked. AT&T can't sue you over the DMCA, but there may be... I think really the bigger issue is they're not going to come into your house and take your iPhone away from you. The bigger issue is, can Apple somehow push through iTunes some way of disabling this phone? In other words, sure, I have an iPhone. I have an AT&T iPhone. I'd love to use it with T-Mobile. I actually, I still have T-Mobile account. I actually had to get an AT&T account. I didn't want an AT&T account. I'm thinking maybe I'll go back to T-Mobile, but on the other, which by the way charges much less for international roaming. But on the other hand, your warranty's void, right? Apple might stop supporting you, or may even push something down that breaks it. I don't know. What do you think? Are you going to do it? Has somebody done it and want to talk about it? We'll keep your anonymity if you'd like. I'll change your voice if you want. What I think is interesting, this is the bottom line, the moral that I meant to say at the very beginning. The moral of this is you can't dangle candy in front of these hacker kids and expect them to say, okay, fine, you win. They're going to crack it. It's not possible to make a copy system that is uncrackable. We've heard this time and time again. You can't stop them. So what do you do? We'll talk about that too. 8888 Ask Leo. I'd love to talk to you. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte here, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk about tech. Did you see this new Google Sky? We'll talk about that in a little bit. They've added Google Earth, a feature to Google Earth that goes down to the sky. Awesome, just awesome. I tell you, Google's doing things right. And we were talking about AT&T and doing things wrong. You know, Google has now made some noise about participating. They've set the auction. We've been talking about this for the last few months. The FCC auction of the 700 megahertz spectrum, the UHF spectrum. They've set the auction now for January of 2008. And Google, remember, said, well, we would like to participate. We will put up the $4.6 billion bond. You have to have that much to play. It's like you can't sit at the table in Vegas without pushing $4.6 billion in chips forward and saying, I'm all in. They've said, we'll do that. We'll be glad to do that. We'd like to do that, but we want those auctions to be open. We want whoever does win the auction to be able, or not be able, be required to open up that spectrum to others, to sell it at wholesale prices to others. The FCC said not wholesale prices, but we will require some part of that spectrum to be open. So they compromised, and it's unclear whether Google will participate. But I'm hoping they do, and this is how this ties back to AT&T. I'm hoping Google gets in the wireless business. Maybe makes a phone, iPhone-like phone that is unlocked. Doesn't require a wireless carrier. Now that I'd like to see. That's the kind of competition we need. Not this colluding between big companies to take advantage of us, frankly. June, Sonoma, California. Hello, June. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, guy. I need some help. I'm a Photoshop addict, and you helped me about a year ago.
My name is June, and I'm a Photoshop addict. Hi,
That's
June.
It. Please help me. You helped me about a year ago upgrade from my little Mac Cube to an iMac, which I just love.
Aren't you glad you
of
did?
Course, yeah. Yes. Oh, I love it. Except about a month after I did, then they came out with a bigger screen, cheaper, blah, 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 which I know is what happens.
Every year now, from now on.
What was that?
And they'll be doing it every year from now on, I predict. It's like Detroit. Okay. They'll be the new model. So you have, the 2006 iMac.
I know.
The 2007s just came out. We're so excited.
Well, we do traveling in the winter because it's really cold and wet here. And I can't get away from Photoshop for that length of time, so I'm going to have to get a laptop.
Oh, good. But I could spend more of June's money. Yay.
Yes. Because I look at them and I think, hey, a little MacBook, that's not so expensive.
No.
But then if I spend about $400 more, I can get a little bit bigger one and another $400 and I can get this.
Mm-hmm.
What I need to know is what should I get so that I can really do the Photoshop without waiting forever for the, you know, spinning thing. Do I need to go to a MacBook Pro?
No. No, Photoshop will work fine on a MacBook. It's really more about RAM. The MacBooks have fast enough processors. They're Core 2s in there. They're good.
Okay.
The biggest difference between the MacBook and the MacBook Pro, besides screen size, and that's certainly part of it, and you may decide that you can't live with a 13-inch screen in Photoshop.
That's the other thing.
Yeah, that could be. But the biggest difference besides the screen size is the video display hardware, and that's not going to make a big difference on Photoshop.
Right. No, I don't do video.
Yeah, it'll affect your 3D rendering and, you know, your ability to move things like motion. But Photoshop should be fine. So
that would be okay.
Yeah, I use Photoshop on a MacBook all the time. But what you may not like, since you have a 20-inch iMac, is that this screen now is going to, you know, you're going to be a little cramped in there.
Right. Well, then if you go to the MacBook Pro, if you get the bottom of the line, you only get 120 gigabyte hard drive. So with only $400 more, you get the 160.
You see, Apple is not dumb. They're very clever, aren't they? They make it all incremental. So it's just, I can do the 400. Oh, but then I'd like, oh, that's another, I can do that.
Right.
And by the time you're done, it's a $3,000 laptop.
I'll
tell you what, I bought a MacBook when they first came out, the 13-inch.
Right.
And I use Photoshop on it, and I like it. And I like it because it's compact. It's easy for me to carry around. It's very convenient. But it was a little underpowered. Now, remember, mine was the original. The new ones are faster, but it was a little underpowered, not for Photoshop so much, but for Keynote, actually, for my presentations. So I bought a 17-inch MacBook Pro. Now, to me, it's too big. It's more a desktop. So if you're going to put it in the back of an RV and you're never going to carry it anywhere, that probably is okay. But if you want to throw it under your arm, I'd say the 17 is too big. So now it's a question between the 15 and the 13.
I think that's my big question.
Yeah.
17 I don't want. It's too heavy.
It's too heavy. It's too big. I love it.
Yeah.
It's fast, but it's awfully big. Really, I think for Photoshop, RAM is the issue. Now, that there is a difference there between the MacBook and the MacBook Pro. You can get more RAM in your MacBook Pro.
Okay.
And RAM is what really is makes a big difference in terms of Photoshop. I would say that you would want a minimum of 2 gigs, which you could get in the MacBook.
Okay.
And if you go with a MacBook Pro, I'd say get, I can't remember if it's 3 or 4 is the limit. I think 3 was the limit. I think they've gone up to 4.
Okay.
So that would make a difference in terms of, because Photoshop keeps several copies of the picture in memory.
Right.
So I would, you know, it's, I can't decide for you. The MacBook is plenty for Photoshop, but it is a small screen. You'll get better performance on a Pro. You'll get more RAM on a Pro.
Right. Well, and you also get, I don't know if the 2 gigahertz or whatever it is, the processor is speed.
That's not sufficient to make the difference.
Okay.
You're talking purely about screen. These are the two issues, screen size and RAM size. And that's up to you. But I think either would be fine. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Unlimited local and long distance calling for less than $20 a month. Call 888-60-POWER. That's 888-60-POWER. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs. And we are about to talk about, I think, one of my favorite tech subjects, because I've just become more and more of a videophile thanks to this guy, Scott Wilkinson. He's the video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine. You can see it on newsstands or download a copy from AVGuide.com. HomeTheaterTalk.com. And Scott joins us every week to talk about home theater. And I'm not kidding. I've learned a lot. And you've actually prompted me to go out and, you know, upgrade my experience bit by bit here.
I'm so glad.
And I tell you what, it looks good. And it sounds good. I am getting hooked on this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. When you start seeing really good quality images and hearing really good quality sound, there's no going back.
It's really true. Really, really true. So today we're going to talk about something that may be of interest to those of you who have projector TVs, mm-hmm. which and the people who want the big screens, that's what they have, right?
That's what they have, yeah. It's really replicating the commercial cinema experience at home with a screen in front and a projector in back shooting light onto this screen.
But here's a problem, which I had never thought about. The screen.
The screen is a big, solid sheet, which can have all kinds of problems in terms of the acoustics of the room.
I had never thought of that.
Yeah, yeah. Also, there's the issue of if you put your speakers, you have to put your speakers obviously around the screen somewhere.
Right.
If you put them too far apart, say, or too far above or below the picture, then what you're hearing doesn't necessarily correspond exactly with what you're seeing.
It's going to confuse your brain.
It confuses your brain. Now, how do commercial cinemas deal with this? The way they do it is they put the speakers behind the screen. And you might think, well, how does a sound get through? It would sound all muffled and horrible. Well, they do it with what's called an acoustically transparent screen.
What a good idea. I mean, I could see for the center channel especially, you'd really want to have that
correct.
Behind the screen.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, acoustically transparent screens, at least in the commercial cinemas, are made by perforating that solid flat sheet with thousands upon thousands of tiny, tiny holes.
I've noticed that. I've actually walked up to a screen.
Yep.
And you can see them.
You can see them. You can't see them from a normal viewing distance.
No, no.
But you can see them when you walk up right up to the screen. And if listeners, next time you're at the movies, go after the movie, go right up to the front and look at that screen. You will see these teeny tiny holes. And that's to allow the sound to get through from behind the screen.
But don't touch the screen.
No.
Do not touch the screen, please. I beg of you.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely correct. Just look, don't touch.
Yeah.
But the speakers are behind, the front speakers are behind that screen, and the sound is getting through those tiny holes. Now, you can do that at home now as well. A number of companies, in particular Stewart Film Screen, which is probably the biggest, most well-known maker of both commercial and home theater screens, offers this in their home products, what they call micro-perf. Which is tiny little holes, about, as I recall, 5,500 per square foot of these tiny little holes.
Wow. Just so they don't use fishnet stockings. They don't use.
No. That's actually somebody else. I'll get to that in a minute.
That's the ooh-la-la screen manufacturer.
The ooh-la-la, yes, yeah. Right, exactly. No, the Stewart screens, the MicroPerf Stewart screens, have these tiny little holes, and you can just put your speakers behind them. Now, some purists complain that these holes, actually, because there are some holes in the screen that actually cover a total of about 8% of the total screen area.
Oh, they're a little dimmer, aren't they, then?
They are, then they don't reflect as much light. They're a little bit dimmer.
Yeah.
Another problem is that if you place the speaker right behind the screen, the fact that it's coming through these tiny little holes can affect the sound, can roll off the high end, can distort it a little bit. And so generally speaking, you want to put the speakers 6 or 8 inches behind the screen if you have the room to do that. And that requires some extra room, but it certainly does help that problem. A third problem is that these new digital projectors, the DLP projectors or LCOS or LCD, the picture is composed of tiny little pixels, right? Individual, separate little pixels. The interaction between those pixels and the little holes can possibly cause some visual distortion, wavy lines that are called moiré. You've maybe heard of moiré distortion.
Yeah. It looks like it's a pattern, kind of a weird pattern.
Kind of a weird wavy pattern, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you know, with 1080p projectors, the pixels are so small that, this is generally not a problem. 720p projectors, it was more of a problem.
Okay.
But now that we're at 1080p, it's not that much of a problem.
Okay.
There's another company I want to mention that does it a different way. The company is called Screen Research. They're out of France. And instead of punching a bunch of tiny holes in the screen, they make a screen out of a specially woven material.
Fishnet stockings.
Fishnet stockings. And it's from France.
Oh, no. Is it really? So it's like nylons almost.
It's almost like nylons. Now,
oh,
of course, they use a specially patented proprietary microfiber
of course
woven
the French
in a special
would figure this
way.
Out. That's so funny.
You know? But it's... it's basically, it's a loose enough, it's a tight enough weave that when you shine a light on it, or shine a picture on it, it reflects back at you. But it's loose enough to allow sound to come through.
Oh, man.
And you don't have to put the speakers far behind the screen, and it doesn't cause as much of a roll-off as the perforation. And, according to the company, it's close to immune to this moiré distortion that we were talking about.
How much more do I pay for a screen like this?
That's a good question.
Are they really expensive?
Well, good quality screens are generally expensive, and there's just no way around it.
Yeah.
Your basic screen, you're going to plan to spend probably $1,000 or $2,000 at least.
Wow. But you may have spent $8,000 or $9,000 on the projector or more, $30,000 or $40,000.
Yeah. You could spend up to $250,000 on a projector or more than
that. So what's a couple of grand on a screen if you're paying
exactly. Now, I'm just now starting to work on a projector roundup of inexpensive digital projectors in the $3,000 to $6,000 range.
Oh, I'd be next week or the week after, let's talk about that. I'd very much like to know more about that.
Absolutely. I'd be very happy to do that.
Yeah,
and I'll have a little more experience under my belt at that time as well and be able to talk about specific models. But when you're spending that little money, if you can count that as little money, which in the world of projectors it is, then spending another $1,000 or $2,000 on a screen might seem like a lot. But I'm here to tell you, it's so much better. I mean, if anyone has a projector and is at all tempted to like, oh, I'll just shine it on the wall, don't.
I'm going to start calling this the Champagne Wishes and Caviar Dreams segment of the show. Oh, $9,000 projector, $2,000 screen. What the heck?
What the heck?
What the heck?
Well, you know, I mean, if you're a serious movie buff, you
true.
Can replicate the cinema experience at home without the sticky kid kicking the back of your seat, unless it's your own kid, of course.
I have to admit, I 5 years ago, people were saying, you know, we're spending $3,000 on a TV. I just laughed because, you know, we were used to spending a couple of $100 on a TV, but everything's changed, and people are much more accepting now of the fact that, you know, for a really great experience, you do spend more.
You do. And the screen is a critical part of the projection experience.
Right.
And so, you know, you're going to shell out some money, but boy, is it going to look great. And you're going to just get enveloped and involved in that movie to the point where you forget your troubles. And how much is that worth?
Wow, Scott, I didn't know idea you were a philosopher. Scott Wilkinson, video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine. It's at avguide.com. And I love talking to him. Joins us every week talking about home theater. We'll talk again next week, everybody.
I wish we could forget our troubles when it comes to computers, but we can't. They're always there to remind us. 88. Thank you, Scott. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. And let's move on to Jim, who's listening in Cleveland. Hello, Jim. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Hello, Jim. Hello, Jim. Hello, Jim. Did I press the wrong button? Let me try again. I did. I pressed the wrong button. Hi, Jim.
He's done on the line.
I'll try again. I'm just clicking the wrong button.
There he goes.
Hi, Jim.
Casting and everything. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for calling in.
I have a friend who has an issue that I can't seem to figure out. I'm everybody's IT support around, but I can't figure this one out. He, because he can't replicate it. Every time I go into their internet, it works. I leave, and every morning when they boot up and turn on, I have a DSL connection. They have to click Internet Explorer 5, 10, 15 times to get it to catch. Work fine the rest of the day. Next day, they have the same problem.
Are they using the dialer that their DSL provider gave them?
No, I actually set it up where they wouldn't have to.
Good man. Yeah, so they have a router.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the router is the one doing the PPPoE handshake.
Actually, no. I take that back. They don't have a router. Okay. I'm sorry about that. But I did set it up where they do not have to click on the AT&T. They have AT&T.
Well, how are they getting onto AT&T?
It just works.
Yeah. Okay.
Much.
There's the problem, Jim. You kind of. Okay. Here's the deal on.
I did it.
You did it, Jim. So here's the deal on that. Most DSL providers are using something called PPPoE. We thought when we got rid of dial-up, we wouldn't have to use PPP anymore, point-to-point protocol.
Okay.
And that's what you're using when you use a dial-up networking. You know, and you can use Windows version, you can use AT&T's version. There are even free third-party dialers that you can use to make this connection. But something needs to make a connection, almost as if you are dialing in, believe it or not. Because you need to sync up with the PPPoE server. Now, the reason DSL companies do this is that way they can control how much bandwidth they use. They can monitor you. And more importantly, when you're not online, neither are they. And that's what your friends are seeing here. It's not it's I don't even know how it's making a connection without a dialer. It must somehow at some point be somehow signaling home. My suggestion for anybody, and Jim, I would do this for your friends, who is using DSL, is you not plug a computer, DSL or cable, you not plug a computer directly into the cable modem or the DSL modem. You don't have a firewall. You're unprotected. You're right that out there on the internet. Even if you're not sharing internet, get a cheap Linksys $30 or $40 broadband router. They're designed for sharing the internet, but really what it is, if you think about it, is it's the computer between you and the internet. It's a dumb little box that can't be easily hacked that is the locus for anything that happens coming in from the internet. And frankly, what happens is it just says, I don't know what you are, and ignores it, whereas your computer might respond. It also will do the dialing, so it's of particular value for people on DSL. Just get a cheap router, set up the PPPoE information in that router. That's the login and password. This will solve the problem. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. That's the number. 8888-ASK-LEO. Our chat room is at irc.dslextreme.com. They're all talking about this iPhone hack. And maybe I didn't make this clear. People are saying, well, do you have to activate it and then change the SIM? No, you don't. That's the interesting thing about the iPhone. And I think maybe Apple stumbled here. I think Apple thought, well, first of all, Apple wanted to make it easy to activate. So if you get an iPhone, you just go to the Apple store, you buy the iPhone. You just take it home. They don't do anything at the store. And then you activate it by running iTunes and then plugging in the iPhone. And then it goes through the activation. You don't have to activate it to use these unlocking schemes. In fact, you shouldn't activate it because then you'll owe AT&T money. So the point is that you're going to unlock this thing before you activate it. And then you don't have to activate it. Suddenly it's a T-Mobile phone or whoever else you're using for a GSM carrier. T-Mobile in the U.S., that's the only other GSM carrier in the U.S. that I know of. I'm sure there's small ones. But say Rogers in Canada or T-Mobile in Germany or Orange or O2 or whoever the other carriers are worldwide, the GSM carriers, you would plug their SIM card. You plug their SIM card into the iPhone and you don't need to activate it. Now, here's the thing. You still get to use it as an iPod. It still plugs in and then you run iTunes and the iTunes will see it's a, you know, will sync it as an iPod and everything. Now, that's the thing that Apple could kind of pull the plug on, I think. The question is, will they or do they dare? A lot of people hacked Apple TV and there was a lot of concern that once you hack Apple TV, you know, you're always vulnerable to Apple coming along, updating it and reversing everything. That happened with TiVos when we hacked our TiVos. TiVo would push an update and boom, your hack is gone. Well, and Apple has not done that with the Apple TV. Of course, they don't have a partner as they do with the iPhone. And a pretty sticky partner, I would guess. Paul, Burbank, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Paul. I am just not good today with the buttons. Hi, Paul. How are you today? Go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm sorry. I pushed the wrong button again.
Okay, yeah. My mouse cursor was freeze on the screen after about 15 minutes. And then if I reboot, it usually would come up again, but then it would freeze again after about another 15 to 30 minutes.
But the reboot fixed it.
Yeah, but only for short time.
Now, this might be hard to answer, but does this the whole thing die, or is it just the mouse freezing? In other words, if you have a clock on the screen, does that continue to tick, or do the programs continue to run in the background? Or is it just the mouse, or is it the whole thing?
It's just the mouse.
So the computer seems to be operating still.
Yeah, the computer's fine.
That's very different, obviously, because if your computer's hanging after 15 minutes, that's one thing. So you think it's just the mouse. If you unplug,
no, I know it's just the mouse.
You know it is. If you unplug the mouse and plug it back in, what happens?
I haven't done that, but I did reinstall the mouse software.
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, no, that's the first thing to do. A couple other things to do would be try another mouse.
Okay.
But I think what's probably happening is the driver is crashing or something's interacting with the driver. If it happens after 15 minutes each time, there's two kinds of things that can happen on a computer that would happen after a period of time. One is overheating, obviously, the longer you run it. Overheating, and so something could be getting hot and stop working. There's a, you know, one mechanism for this is something called a cold solder, which is a bad solder that either works or doesn't work after getting heated up. Either the connection is broken or it gets made after being heated up, and so that changes the characteristic of the computer after warming up. There are lots of things like that a hot computer or a hot mouse controller could do, but this doesn't sound like that. This sounds like the other kind of error you can get after a period of time. It's called a memory leak. Software that it has a bug in it that slowly acquires memory or eats up memory or interferes with a memory in the computer can cause a problem after time. In other words, it gets worse and worse and worse and finally gets so bad it stops working. My suspicion, it's hard to say. I mean, usually mouse drivers are very simple. They come with Windows. It's not the kind of thing you necessarily install. You might try uninstalling the special mouse software. It could be a USB driver issue as well.
Okay.
Do you have mouse software? I mean, is it a Logitech or...
It's a Logitech.
Okay, so you're using the Logitech software.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and checked for new software.
Okay, go on the website?
Yeah, go to Logitech, check for new software. They're always updating that. Also, try uninstalling it. That mouse will still work. It may not have all the fancy features, but it will still work without any Logitech software at all, because it's a standard HID or human interface device, and Windows has a driver for it. And so, what we're trying to do is figure out what software is failing here. It may also be that there's a program running on your system that kicks in, you know, spyware even that kicks in after a certain period of time and is making it break.
Maybe I have another question.
Sure.
I'm going to get a new computer anyways, pretty soon. But best way to transfer the data?
Is it Windows to Windows?
Yes.
Yeah, your new computer will have Vista on it, and Vista has a pretty good transfer feature. If you're going from XP to Windows, or Vista rather, it kind of makes me nervous whenever you're moving from one operating system to another. It makes me a little bit nervous to do too much transferring from one to the other of applications. The Windows program will do that. But, you know, you may be copying over problems. So
I'm just going to do the data.
Yeah, if you just want the data, just get your home folder, your login folder. You know, inside Documents and Settings, there'll be a couple of folders, one that says Administrator and one that has your login. If you get what's in your login folder, usually you're fine.
Okay.
That way you won't copy over stuff from XP that Vista can't handle. All right?
Okay, thanks a lot, Neil.
Yeah, try some other... So, on that mouse thing again, try the other USB ports to see if that port's failing. Try another mouse. Try taking out the Logitech drivers. Try putting in new Logitech. These are all different ways to troubleshoot it, to kind of narrow it down. It's either hardware or software, right? Now, if it's an interaction between your mouse driver and another program you've installed, that gets very hard to diagnose. Very tricky. You got to figure out what's causing this. Who's having the problem with whom? There's all sorts of issues that can happen with that. And if it's a mouse, by the way, I didn't even think of this, but the Bob has mentioned this in the chat room. I'm assuming everybody's using an optical mouse now, right? With no moving parts. But if it's a mouse that has a rolling ball, make sure that's clean. It wouldn't fail after 15 minutes, but it might make it a little flaky if it's not clean. That's why I like optical mice. No moving parts. I've got lots more calls. I want to hear from you, too, though. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk about high tech. Show notes are online at techguylabs.com. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Good day to you, Leo Laporte, the tech guy here. 8888 Ask Leo. If you'd like to talk about tech, that's 888-827-5536. Show notes are online at techguylabs.com. We've got the Stick'em video stream going. You can see that at twit.tv/live. I only have one camera going right now. I don't have enough bandwidth for two cameras to run at the same time. So we'll get some more bandwidth in here on the next show. And I'll have the Ustream and the Stick'em running. I didn't realize it, but the frame rates have been low. They've been low as a result of trying to get too much going on in one business DSL. You'd think. But we can, you listen to the show. You don't need to watch the show. Let's listen to the show. You can also go to our chat room, irc.dslextreme.com, and join the 400 or so people who are having some fun in there, making fun of me, talking in the back of the class. But the best way to participate is to call 888-ASK-LEO. I heard a rumor that the Windows validation server has been down, or the Windows Genuine Advantage. I guess that's their validation server. They've been having some outage problems. Started late last night. Users of both Windows XP and Vista can't validate. Why? You know, once again, we're seeing how worthless these anti-piracy measures are. The company says they're aware, Microsoft says they're aware of a major server outage affecting users across the globe. That's nice. Phil Yu, who's the WGA project manager, promises he will not sleep until the problem is fixed. You must be a little exhausted right now, Phil. It's been about 15 hours. Microsoft is telling users who are affected, try again later. Looks like they'll have a fix in place, they say. Get this, Phil, you don't want to hear this. Close your ears, Phil. Tuesday. No sleep till Tuesday, Phil. You can't validate patches. You can't validate Windows. Some people, I imagine, are even being told, sorry, this is an illegal copy of Windows. You can't use it. Not because it's an illegal copy of Windows. Not because it's illegal, but because Microsoft can't get its server up. If your attempt to validation and it fails, your installation will be marked as non-genuine. Do not reboot. Once you do so, you'll lose all functionality. Well, this is a good system, isn't it? Why do people put up with this? I just don't understand. It feels to me like Microsoft saying you're all criminals. You're guilty until proven innocent. And now their system breaks, so we're all guilty. Dave, San Jose, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Long-time Netcast listener.
Thank you.
I've listened to a lot of what you say, but I may be in a little trouble here.
Uh-oh.
All my machines are connected via wireless, and I've got a NAS backup drive attached to the router.
Okay.
And when I was straightening up, I turned off the drive, and I went to power it back up. It didn't come back up.
Uh-oh.
So the drive is only about 2.5 years old, and I didn't think it was that old.
Well, you never know. I mean, drives can fail in 1 week. They can fail in 5 years. They can fail in 10 years. I mean, you just don't know.
Yeah.
Although, remember this Google study that we talked about some time ago. Google has thousands, tens of millions, probably, of hard drives in place. And they've been monitoring them all these years. And according to this study, the hard drives are most likely to fail early on, like in the first 6 months, and then after 2 years. And there's about an 8% failure rate after 2 years. That means 8% of all hard drives in service after 2 years will fail in any given year. So you could have one of the eight. Now, your NAS is a single drive unit?
Yeah, the old one was, yeah.
See, that's one of the reasons I like... On a network attached storage, and NAS is basically a large drive that you put on the Ethernet, you put on the network for backup purposes. And I like to use RAID 5 for that reason, because if a drive fails, you just swap in another drive.
Yeah. Well, for budget reasons, I replaced it with a RAID 1.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, it gives me a little more a sense of security.
It does. Yeah. It does. Although, I, you know, if it's a good RAID, hardware RAID device, and if it's an asset, probably is, that's fine.
Yeah. But when I talked to the manufacturer, the only advice they would give me was to send it to some drive recovery place.
Ay. That's going to cost you thousands.
Yeah, and I'm pretty certain, but not certain, that everything that was backed up is on the different machines.
So you've lost everything? This is your only backup? No, you still have all the stuff, but it's spread out.
I'm pretty certain, but not positive I do. Just spread out. But when I pulled the drive out from the enclosure, and I put it inside a USB enclosure, and when I connected to the PC, the PC saw a raw drive.
Okay. But this was a RAID drive? You had two drives, RAID 1? Or was this just
this
is a standalone.
The one that failed.
Okay. So it sees a drive, but it doesn't see a format.
Right.
I think you're fine. You could recover it. What that means, you don't need to send it to a company. Again, if you're a longtime listener, you know I've talked about the two kinds of failures. A hard drive can have a hardware failure. That's when you need to send it to somebody who's going to open it up and it's going to cost you thousands. Or it can have a software failure, and that can usually be fixed by software. So either the partition table or the catalog was destroyed, or, you know, perhaps something went wrong with the formatting. But in most cases, that can be recovered. So the question is, what do you do to recover it, right?
Yeah.
You know, the program that I like that I would run on it, but you can't use it in a USB enclosure. You'd have to put it into a system and put it on the IDE or SATA chain is SpinRite, and you've heard me talk about that before, too.
Yeah, okay.
That'll work on it. That's the one I would probably start with, because that's going to modify the... It depends what's wrong. If it's simply, the FAT is destroyed or the catalog is destroyed, SpinRite won't help there. It doesn't work at that level. It doesn't know anything about file systems. It only knows about physical sectors. If it's a physical sector problem, it'll be able to recover those files and fix it. If it's a operating system error, a file system error, then you need a file system level tool, you know, like Norton or there are a lot of tools that'll do that will recover the partition table. So an undelete program might be one to look at. The key on this is not to modify this drive in any way.
Right.
But to just examine it and pull, if you're going to do any recovery, don't do it on drive, but pull stuff off of it. So it's hard to say. So it sees a drive, but it doesn't look formatted. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, it sees the two partitions for the two user accounts that were on the drive.
And is this NAS running Linux or Windows, or what is it running? Do you know?
It's running Linux.
Okay. So the first thing I would do is try to boot into Linux with a live CD, not look at it with Windows. Windows won't see anything.
Yeah.
So your drive may...
bootable copy.
Okay. So were you looking at it with Linux?
No, I haven't tried that yet. But
yes. Well, Windows won't... That's what you were seeing is what Windows will see when it looks at a Linux drive and say, well, there's nothing here. So, because it doesn't understand ext2 partition. So you need to boot into Linux and then look at it. And most Linuxes have tools for recovery at that point. So I think you probably, if you boot from Linux, that's the first thing to do. I bet you can see it. It's, you know, it sounds to me now at this point like it's the NAS that failed, not the drive.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because it worked fine until I turned it off. And then when I turned it on...
Yeah.
It never completed.
Yeah, it didn't give that typical hard drive failure error. It sounds like a hardware failure.
Yeah.
You know, I think you'll be all right. You certainly don't want to send it to a $1,000 recovery place because the drive's spinning up and it's
not
visible.
Unless I was really sick.
Unless you're really desperate.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about your experience with Carbonite then?
Yeah.
Because I have multiple strategies. I have CDs, DVDs.
Good man. You have been listening. Excellent, Dave.
Yeah. But with my cable modem bandwidth, if I were to use my Carbonite and back up 400 gigabytes...
Forget it.
Yeah, I'd be...
It'd take forever.
Yeah.
So that's the one issue with online backup. I love online backup because they, you know, you're kind of guaranteed it's always there, but you have to pick and choose what you back up. I use Carbonite running on my PC all the time, and it's backing up just my podcast production stuff I really, really can't lose. And I've, and it's always running in the background. The nice thing about Carbonite is you can run it at a low priority, so it doesn't slow anything down. It's just kind of trickling up new changes. It only uploads changed stuff. And I have used it. In fact, I just used it a couple of weeks ago. I lost a podcast and I did a restore. And it also is a little slow on the restore because you have to download it. So that's the disadvantage of any online backup solution is it's online. So it's only as fast as your internet access is. Certainly not as fast as copying out over the network or even to an, or to another drive. On the other hand, you have this kind of peace of mind. And I, for the really critical stuff, that's what I recommend. It's what I use. And I should, disclaimer here, they're a sponsor. And so to be completely fair and equal, there are other solutions like that. In fact, if you've got a .Mac account, you've got 10 gigabytes. Windows now has its own system at Windows Live. What do they call it? I've forgotten the name. They have a clever name for it. But that's limited to 512 megabytes, so it's kind of small. You can buy more. Mozy, M-O-Z-Y.com. There are a number of these companies that'll do this. I use Carbonite and prefer Carbonite, but again, they're a sponsor, so just the disclaimer there. It works very, very well for cases like where you have specific information you know you cannot afford to lose. In my case, podcasts. Having lost podcasts in the past, I have a very elaborate backup situation. And I'm glad I do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number. 8888 Ask Leo. That's 888-827-5536. Let's talk about tech. In all its forms and fashions, if you've not used Google Earth, highly recommended. What a great program Google Earth is. What a lot of fun it is to use. And now when you upgrade to the latest version, what is that, 4.2? The very first thing you'll see is, oh, you know we have now Google Sky. Explore stars, constellations, planets, galaxies, and more. I love this. They're so cool. If you've not downloaded it, it's absolutely free from from earth.google.com. It is, you've used Google Maps, so you kind of know what it is in that regard. And it has a big database of sites. And you can click on these sites, and it's so fun. I mean, you can click like Eiffel Tower or Paris or the Colosseum in Rome, and you'll go there. And it zooms into it. It's so neat. And you get this great satellite view of it. Well, now you can go to the sky, too. And there's a little icon to switch right at the top between sky and Earth. And the same thing you've been able to do with Google Earth, you know, zoom to points of interest, you can do now with constellations. There's a Hubble showcase. Oh, clusters of galaxies. I mean, this is nebulae. What a great way to turn people on to astronomy. So I'm looking at the Hubble holes and quasar, black holes and quasars from the Hubble, NGC 7742. You double click it. It zooms around in the sky, zooms out. I don't know what I'm going to see when I'm in a black hole. You won't see anything, right? No, there it is. Oh, I see. So you see. I see. Very cool. You see the stars surrounding it, and then you see where the black hole ought to be. And a beautiful picture from the Hubble. Oh, man. So the NGC is 7742 is the nearest, what is that, a galaxy? And then you double-click it. What a great thing for students. You double-click the black hole or whatever, and it will talk about it. While it may first appear as a sunny-side-up egg, it's actually NASA Hubble Space Telescope's face-on snapshot of the small spiral galaxy NGC 7742, but it's powered by a black hole. It's a Seyfert 2. What a way to learn. Oh, man. Wouldn't it be great to be in school today and all the things you can do online? So if you haven't downloaded it, highly recommended. Earth, absolutely free. They have a pro version. You don't need that. earth.google.com. Kent is on the line from Studio City, California. Hello, Kent. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. I have sort of a two-part question, but right before I get into it, I just wanted to say I moved out here to L.A. about 2 years ago and discovered you, and you've been truly one of the high points of my being out here.
Wow.
I've really enjoyed your show a lot.
More than Disneyland? Wow.
Well, maybe.
All right. What can I do for you, Kent?
Well, I'm a musician, do a lot of recording, and I built the PC that I've used for quite a while now. It's a dual AMD MP2000s with a couple gigs of RAM in it. And it's getting long in the tooth. And so the first part of the question is, as far as I just kind of looked around on the net and tried to get an idea of what a realistic benchmark would be in comparison, because the 2000s were called 2000 because it was supposed to be equivalent to a 2 gigahertz.
Right. That confuses everything, doesn't it? Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, you know, you got much faster buses now, and I'm using PC-133 RAM, and, you know, so I'm trying to get an idea of, like, what would a Core 2 Duo 2 gigahertz with a couple gigs of matching RAM, how would that really stack up to what I've got now?
The first lesson of this 2000 plus that AMD is doing is that you cannot look at gigahertz when you're looking at chips. Some chips are more efficient than others, get more done in fewer gigahertz. In fact, that's really true of the Core 2. The Core 2, Intel doesn't tout this around, but the fact is the Core 2 is really almost a Pentium 3, not a Pentium 4. By going back to a simpler chip, they were able to get more done with fewer clock cycles. So they don't, you know, that's why nobody anymore wants you to look at gigahertz. Unfortunately, that's a really easy number to put on the side of a computer. It's what everybody wants to know, how many gigahertz. But it doesn't really tell you anything anymore. It doesn't tell you how much work it'll do. That AMD isn't a 2 gigahertz processor. It's something like a 1.6 gigahertz processor. But they say, well, it operates as fast as a 2 gigahertz processor, so we call it the 2000 plus. Well, that really muddies the waters. AMD wasn't the first to do it. In fact, a number of manufacturers did it before them. And Intel is kind of moving away from clock speeds as a way to designate processors. You know, the only way to really tell is to do benchmarks. Now, you're particularly using this for sound, right? For recording?
Yeah, exactly. Which that's part of the next part of it.
You're more interested. You're less interested, frankly, in clock speeds, and more interested in, you know, what's, you know, how fast the hard drive is. For instance, is more important to you.
That's important for track count, but for plugins and things like that.
You're running a lot, okay, and you're running a lot of tracks at once and a lot of plugins. You're right. Processor speeds.
Yeah, I mean, I've maxed out the dual processor, and I could get.
I would look at, for what you're doing, I would look at the news, the quad system, which is two Xeons with cores, two dual cores in each, so you've got four cores.
Right.
And as long as the software supports that. Now, you have to make sure your software is threaded and will support multiple cores.
If it does,
and I'm sure the higher-end music programs do, you're going to see a huge improvement.
Yeah, it will. But that's kind of the next question.
Hang on. Let's talk more about this, because this applies to everyone, music production or not. How do you decide what machine's better? We'll talk about it as we continue. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hang on.
Stadium, and I wrote your number on the 50-yard line. You were always a perfect one in a valedictorian.
The Tech Guy is brought to you by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or visit them online at dslextreme.com. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. We're talking with Kent, who does music production. What kind of music you produce, Kent?
Hello?
Yeah, what kind of music do you produce?
Well, it's pretty much my own stuff. A lot of various rock that has a lot of soundtrack elements to it.
Cool. So you have you're using what, Logic or?
Well, I'm pretty firmly in the PC camp. However, being out here in LA, as you might have noticed, if you're not Mac, you're little people. So,
isn't that rotten? That's just not right. That's just not right. So the real issue on how to measure the performance of a computer, I mean, if reviewers will use what they call real world benchmarks that use actual programs. The problem is, of course, if you don't use those programs, it's not real world for you, but they'll try to give you some idea of the performance. You can look at sites like AnandTech for individual chip and motherboard performance specs. They benchmark those individually. You can look at places like PC Magazine, ExtremeTech.com, CNET for benchmarks of whole systems. But it really,
it's not that useful. First of all, often they'll make a big deal over differences over just a few percentage points, and that isn't going to be noticeable to an end user. The overall thrust of what I would say to you is that the AMD chips currently are way behind. The Intel Core 2s are currently the most efficient, the fastest chips out there. Now, if you're comparing Core 2 to Core 2, then clock speed does matter. You know, a 2 gigahertz Core 2 is faster than a 1.6 gigahertz Core 2. How much faster? Well, that's 20%. Is that enough to make a difference that you'll notice? Possibly, depending on what you're doing. And as I said, it's not just the processor. You have to look at what you're doing. In some cases, it's the hard drive speed. You mentioned the bus speed. The amount of RAM is relevant. All of this impacts the speed of the computer. Now, sounds like you're doing stuff that is what we call compute intensive, where the processor is really the slowest part of it, the gating factor. So if it's compute intensive, that's when you start looking at chips with more cache, more L2 cache. That makes a huge difference. More than clock speed. More than clock speed is the amount of the L2 cache. That's onboard, it's very fast RAM on the chip. So it's it's running at the same speed as the chip where it stores recently accessed instructions. By putting that stuff there and data, and by putting that stuff there, it can very quickly access it again. Having a lot of efficient L2 cache makes a big difference. Again, this is the kinds of engineering improvements that Intel made to the Core 2 that I think makes the Core 2 very good. If you look at a Core 2, right. A Xeon, which they have a considerable amount of L2 cache, and maybe the dual cores, and getting two of them, I think you're going to see an amazing improvement in overall speed.
All right. So if I were to go Mac, use Boot Camp, a lot of times would Boot Camp slow me down? Or
no, I wouldn't go Mac unless you want to use Mac sometimes.
Well, it would probably be. I mean, I'm mostly PC, but from a compatibility perspective, it might be nice.
Right.
So I'm just
When the Mac Pros came,
performance.
No, you won't. When the Mac Pros came out, they actually were priced slightly lower than comparable Dells with the dual Xeons. I think they're very comparable in price. When you boot into Boot Camp, it is a Windows machine. All the resources are devoted to Windows. It runs just as fast as a Windows machine. The one area where you're a little bit behind is Apple does not put the fastest video cards in there yet, or still. That shouldn't matter to you if you're doing audio.
No, not much.
Matters for gamers is who it matters for. Pretty much that's it. The cards they put in are fast enough, certainly, but they're not the top of the line video cards. You could put faster cards in. I would say that a Mac would be a good choice, but only if you're going to run only Windows, get a Dell. But if you're going to run Windows and you want some Mac capabilities, you have to get a Mac in order to run the Mac OS X. And I think a Mac Pro is a good choice. It's comparable price wise, and it's nicely. I'll tell you one thing: it's well made hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, you never saw an easier machine to add hard drives to. I mean, it's just the cooling is good. They're very relatively quiet. And that's important for a studio environment, of course.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Leo. I appreciate
sure can.
It.
I think a Mac Pro sounds like the right way for you to go. It's crazy to buy a Mac if you're not going to run an OS X. I'm not recommending a Mac by any means for somebody who wants to run Windows. But if you want to run both, and that's really the advantage Apple has right now. By the way, Apple's on a roll. Their PC sales were down slightly the last quarter, but they now have 17% of the laptop marketplace. And they are the number three computer manufacturer. It's Dell, HP, Apple. So, I think people are starting to see that a Mac is a good choice. I think, this is my rule of thumb. Windows for business and gaming. No question about it. You want to play games, you're going to be a Windows guy or gal. But for a home user who wants to do video or audio production or do graphic arts, do Photoshop, the Mac is a much better choice. It really is. Slightly pricier, but not as much as I think people assume. I think people assume that you pay a big premium for a Mac. It's not the same thing between the premium between a Saturn and a BMW, let's say. There's a slight premium. Glenn is on the line from Murrieta, California. Hello, Glenn. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for calling.
Great. When you were checking out that Galaxy on Google Sky,
yeah.
Did you, by chance,
see my support for my web hosting company?
What do you mean? Do you have an ad in there? Do you have an ad in that galaxy?
Well, I don't.
They've moved there.
Support tickets must go there. I think that's where the support tickets go.
The support goes to Galaxy GGC4472. That's interesting. What happened? What's going on?
Well, the long story short is I did a Who Is database search of my domain names here recently because I got the tip-off from one of the threads in the hosting forum, and lo and behold, my domain names are no longer in my name. They're in some guy's name I won't mention, but some media company from Singapore.
Yeah. He's hijacked this. This happens. And what they do is they write a letter to the hosting, the registrar, rather, and they say to the registrar, I want to move my site from this contact to this contact. And they effectively take it over. Now, the registrars are supposed to have controls in place to make that impossible. Who's the...
Go ahead.
This is the important distinction. Not your hosting company, but the registrar.
Right.
That's who you need to go to.
Right.
You may have registered it through the hosting company, but the registrar is the one who made the transfer.
Right. Right. And I think I know who that is, but they don't deal with the public per se. You're really supposed to do a support ticket through your web host company, but if they're not answering them for, you know, a week to 2 weeks,
that's frustrating.
You know, I might as well get a plane ticket because a plane ticket would be faster.
Yeah, you could fly to Singapore, huh? What? Let me ask you. Let's name names. Who's the hosting company and who's the registrar?
Well, I did all this through the hosting company is globedomain.com.
Okay.
And when I obviously signed up for these and got these registered, they did all the registration. I think
The Who Is will tell you who the registrar is.
I'm sorry.
When you do a Who Is on your domain, it'll tell you who the registrar is.
I think what I checked out last night is that it's RPC or something. I have to look.
And they won't respond. They won't respond to you, huh?
Well, I've seen in a thread that they, after somebody like contacted them and said I can't get a hold of my hosting company, then they said, "Well, we'll try and address your issue for you."
They're responsible for letting your site go.
Right.
Without proper protection.
Okay.
And you want to make sure when you get, most registrars will make it pretty difficult to transfer a site like that. But this happens all the time, nevertheless.
Right.
You should be able to go to them and say, this is a screw up. I want it back. And they should instantly respond.
Right.
And you're right that Globe Domain is that's your first line of that's really disappointing. I mean, they seem like a good company just looking at their site.
They've been a great little company, fully featured, really great, you know, in terms of cost. Of course, I have someone at work that always reminds me you get what you pay for, of course. But, I've been very happy, and I'm here sticking it out with them through thick and thin, and it's just getting really, really hard to stick it out with.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
And
named names. Maybe somebody's listening from Globe Domain. You want to take care of Glenn here.
We got a promise about a month and a half ago that things would turn around. I mean, the forums were full of spam for about 4 to 6 months. They cleaned it up finally, but I think that's where the damage was done. You know, they let it run amok.
Right.
And then, you know, next thing you know, you do a Who Is, and there you go. And, of course, you know, I have a lot of undeliverables in my inbox. I had to actually delete that email account, you know, because there's just no way to stop it.
Yeah, I'm sorry this has happened. I mean, it's incredibly frustrating. There's a distinction between the person who hosts your site, in other words, has the hardware and is doing the hosting, and your registrar. The registrar is ICANN approved. ICANN gives them the power to create a domain. Now, many registrars then sublet, in effect, that ability to smaller companies or to hosting companies. If you're not getting a first of all, do the Who Is, find out who the registrar is. Go to them. If you're not getting response from them, go to ICANN. I mean, go up the chain and complain. Your domain has been hijacked. And there is this happens, and they have a resolution process. And then you want to make sure that they do, you know, I would figure out how it got hijacked. Did they have access to your email? Usually most registrars will send you an email saying, well, we want your approval. And only the holder of that email account can do it. In fact, it used to be you'd have to have a driver's license. You'd have to fax in information. I know with VeriSign, there was a 15 hoops you had to jump through. I hope that they're not making it too easy. So I would inquire about that. You might even... Now, Sasha's telling me that GoDaddy will take care... That's the other thing, is you go to another registrar and say what's happened. And maybe somebody like GoDaddy or Dotster or one of the more responsive registrars will say, we'll take care of this. And we'll go to ICANN for you. We'll go to this other registrar. We'll say it's been hijacked. See if you can get their support. Sasha says GoDaddy will do that for you. And then in future, use domain locking. I use this at Dotster and GoDaddy. I use both registrars. Lock the domain so it requires extra hoops to jump through before somebody can get it. That's usually free or very inexpensive, and that'll protect you. More of your calls to come. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So glad you're here today. We're talking about technology, computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, domain names, all of that kind of stuff. Kind of cool. It's a 17-year-old teenager named George Holtz, a New Jersey teenager who was the first to crack the iPhone's activation. His method, I don't recommend, involves soldering, involves breaking open the iPhone. It's tricky to do. But it takes about 2 hours. But it works. You can unlock it. I'm not sure I would recommend it. Now, there are these two software ways to unlock the iPhone. Looks like they're being held up by the lawyers from AT&T, however. So I'm not sure if we'll see these or not. iPhoneunlocking.com, still not public. And if you go to their blog... They say they're going to release a press release in the next few hours. They're kind of shut down. Seems AT&T, I'm reading from the blog, is a bit annoyed at the idea of unlocking iPhones. A middle-of-the-night phone call from a Silicon Valley law firm is slowing down the release of the software to you. Stay tuned. Maybe they have software, maybe they don't. But maybe it's going to be a while before we see it. And I imagine AT&T is going to be pretty aggressive in keeping these software unlocks because it's so easy. It's just done in software off the market. But again, and this is the most important point in all this. We talked about it last hour. If people want it, it's pretty hard to stop them. I don't know of a copy protection scheme yet that's going to keep people from doing this kind of thing. In the long run. Michael is on the line from Gera, Germany. Hello, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Are you in the service? Are you stationed there? Or are you working in there? What brings you to Germany?
I am from Germany. I'm German.
You're German? You have a wonderful Southern accent.
Really? Southern accent, huh? Okay, well, I lived in Kentucky for a few years.
Ah, there we go. you sound like an American from Kentucky, which is, by the way, I think one of the most beautiful of the American accents. It's a very soft, beautiful accent.
Yeah.
Well, what can I do for you, Michael? I'm so glad you listen in Germany. That's great.
Oh, I do. I listen to the Tech Guy podcast and the other one as well, the Twit.
Thank you very much.
And My problem here is with my monitor. I have a TFT. It's a Fujitsu Siemens.
Okay.
And a 19-inch one. And the problem I've been having for about 2 weeks now is that when I boot the computer, the first screen comes on, which it, like it should be, and there is this scrolling bar on the bottom of the screen, and that's all fine and well. The next screen that comes up should be the one where the admin button is that I have to click to get into the computer
right.
or to start the Windows software.
Right.
What happens instead, though, is the screen becomes white, basically, or a very bright gray, and it does so from the outside in. The whole process takes about 2, maybe 3 seconds, and that's all I get to see. So what I do is I recycle the monitor. I switch it off, back on, is usually it solves it after recycling it once. Sometimes I have to recycle it twice, three times, five times. Up to now, it's always restarted, and it was okay. The monitor works fine. But every time I switch off the computer, switch it back on, this happens. Any ideas?
Yeah, it's probably a hardware issue. I presume that let me ask some diagnostic questions. The big difference between that gray screen that you see and the color screen that is the login screen is the resolution. It's a simple 16 color screen that's 640 by 480 when you're seeing the initial login stuff. It's very straightforward. As soon as you go to a color screen, the high resolution color screen, you're using the Windows drivers. And it's pushing a different refresh rate all of a sudden. Can you boot in a safe mode? Does it, you get the same response there?
I haven't tried that yet.
And here's why I'm asking. Safe mode will boot you back into, it's 640 by 480, 16-bit or 16-color screen. It'll boot you back into this low-res screen. If it works fine in safe mode, but it then you pretty much know now, well, it's not Windows. It's probably not the computer. It could be the video card. It could be the video driver. It could be the monitor. The fact that you could cycle the monitor tells me it's probably the monitor. Because by cycling the monitor, you're not changing anything in the way the computer behaves. You're just telling the monitor, try again, try again. And I think what's happening is the monitor is not getting a refresh rate or not understanding the refresh rate or the signal that it's getting from the computer. And it's taken a while for it to get in sync with it.
Okay.
Have you tried that monitor on another computer?
Right, exactly. Now, I haven't done that yet. I have a laptop, and I can do that to just find out whether...
Oh, it's a laptop.
What I have done... Go ahead.
This is a desktop computer, though, you're talking about.
The one I'm using right now is a desktop.
Okay,
Also, if we use those emails.
Yeah, okay, got it. Okay. So, yeah, you try it with a laptop or try it with something else, but my suspicion is... I mean, it could be the monitor software, it could be the driver software, it could be Windows, but my suspicion is it's the monitor itself, because you're not changing anything when you switch it back off and on. You're just telling the monitor, you know, pick up that signal again.
Yeah. So basically what I have done is I have, just to verify that, I downloaded the newest driver for this. It's like a GeForce graphics card.
Okay.
7500 LE. I've downloaded the latest driver and nothing happened, so it's the same problem.
It didn't fix it, yeah. And you're doing exactly the right thing. You just want to try different components to see which one is affecting it. Now, remember, there's also a monitor, and I'm going to put this in quotes, monitor driver. It really isn't software. It's just a descriptor that Windows uses to understand what refresh rate the monitor can use, what resolutions, and so forth. It may be that you're using a refresh rate that's marginal on that monitor. So make sure that you're using, when you know, go to the display control panel and make sure that you're using the not a generic monitor descriptor, but the actual Fujitsu Siemens monitor descriptor that describes your particular monitor. And that'll make sure you don't put in a setting that the monitor cannot handle. It may be that it can't handle it very well.
Oh, that's possible.
Yeah. There's also... it might be worth trying. Somebody in the chat room sending this along to us, DG Murdoch. Thank you, DG. At tft.vanity.dk, an online monitor test that might be worth trying to see if you can, you know, work that monitor and cause problems. But I suspect it's the monitor itself. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. We're talking about this exciting stuff that's changing the world, about unlocking iPhones, setting up websites, buying new computers, home theater screens, all of that stuff. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number to call, 8888-ASK-LEO. If you'd like to talk tech, that's 888-827-5536. We have a website available with the notes from the show and more, and a lot more to come soon. Sasha's doing a great job redesigning the site, and I went live briefly this morning, but it's not quite ready, but there's a lot more to do, but we'll go live soon with the new site. It's looking great. You can go to techguylabs.com right now, and that'll get you to the website. You'll also find a link there for our chat room, irc.dslextreme.com. Over 400 people in there. It's a little busy, but it's a lot of fun. And thanks to Dan and Dustin and Mick and Mike and Shuby and Sasha, we're in there moderating things. Sasha's moderating from a internet cafe in Spain, I understand. And so it's great to have them there. And if you want to chat, you'll find it's a good, safe place to gather. Also, video of the show, as always, today on Stick'Em. But you can go to twit.tv/live to see it. I will have both cameras running tomorrow. Only one camera today. Both cameras running tomorrow, I promise. But the main thing I'd like you to do is call me. 8888-ASK-LEO. One of the things we were talking about in the chat room a couple of minutes ago during the break is the idea of setting up a forum on the new website. We'll call it the Tech Guy, Team Tech Guy, or the Tech Guy Army, or Leo's Army, or something like that. But where people who are experts, and we have so many great experts and knowledgeable people in the chat room and listen to the show, can kind of participate, helping to answer questions. I get so many more questions than I can answer on the show. Hundreds of emails a day that I just can't get to them all. And I don't have a staff to answer them all. So I think what I'm thinking we'll do is we'll set up a little forum where people who want to can participate. Maybe we'll have, you know, a prize each month for the person who helps the most people or something like that. But I'm going to work on that. I think that'll be a good way to get more answers out there. We have so many good, smart people in here. I've always thought of this as a user group, kind of an on-air user group. And that's how user groups work. We help each other, right? So the rumor floating around that new iPods will be announced in about a week, September 5th. Apple, you know, this is, by the way, I want to underscore this. This is rumor. And when it comes to Apple rumors, you know, I don't give them any credence at all. Apple is so good at controlling leaks that I doubt that anybody really knows what Apple's going to do. And you certainly aren't going to read it in a rumor site. However, I have to say, in this case, there are reasons to think there is some truth to it. It started on a website called, I think, 9to5Mac. And a new rumor site I hadn't heard much of, number5mac.com. And they posted pictures of about the ugliest iPod I've ever seen, a fat little Nano. In fact, the picture was of these two little fat Nanos within a Photoshop screen. So I looked at it, I thought, well, this is clearly bogus. First of all, it's ugly, and Apple is not likely to release something that ugly. Second of all, it's a Photoshop. We're even seeing the Photoshop frame. But then Apple did something very interesting. They sent a cease and desist letter to 9to5Mac and to Engadget and other sites that republished this photo, saying, "That's our property. Take it down. That's our property." What? Now, Apple has in the past ignored this kind of thing with other, turned out to be true, leaked pictures. But you think when Apple sends out a cease and desist saying that picture is ours, that gives it a lot of credence. Suddenly that means that picture, maybe it's not a Photoshop. Maybe it's real. Why would Apple be saying that's our picture? Everybody pulled it down. Well, because they have good legal grounds. If that's their picture that was stolen from them, you better pull it down. However, Engadget put up an artist's rendering. So if you go to Engadget, you could still see what those fat little Nanos looked like. If that's really the new Nano, I'll be stunned. I do, on the other hand, think that Apple will be announcing new iPods probably soon, in time for the holiday buying season, time to get them out into the channel. It's due. We haven't seen a new iPod in a while. The only question in my mind is, and it's a big one, the $64,000 question. Will it be like the iPhone, which is that touchscreen, the quality of the screen, the size of it, makes it the best iPod ever made. There's only one negative. There's several. There's the fact that it's $600, but the biggest negative is only 8 gigabytes of memory. It's not a very, you know, big iPod.
most people will fill that up way too quickly, especially if you start putting video on it. But if they could make something like the iPhone, minus the phone, minus all everything but the iPod functionality, I'd love to have that scroll with the fingers and all that, and put more memory in there. This would be a heck of an iPod. The question is, will Apple do that? If they do, you know, there's some risk of perhaps cutting into iPhone sales. Maybe they want to make you buy an iPhone just, you know, and all that extra money it's going to cost you with an AT&T subscription just so that you will, you know, they will make more money. Hey, it's a business. Anyway, what do you think? September 5th, is that going to be the day? Is it going to be those fat little nanos? I hope it's not. I think they were ugly. Ugly. Let's talk about it. 8888 Ask Leo. But if I guess the bottom line is, if you're thinking about buying an iPod, you might be prudent to wait a few weeks. Just in case something happens. Maria on the line from Escondido, California. Hello, Maria.
Hi.
Thanks for calling in. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. I have an interesting problem. I actually run a photography business.
Okay.
That now we've all gone digital. So I have a website, and people can go online. And my bread and butter is equestrian photography. So I go to a lot of these horse shows.
Fun.
Yeah, and you know, they love it. My clients love it because they're exhausted, they're tired, they want to go home and look at all their photos online. So it's kind of a win-win situation, except I'm discovering that a few of the more savvy ones are probably able to email or, you know, right-click and download some of my photos, even though I have a watermark on them.
Yeah.
Is there some way that I can disable their ability to right-click, which is, I'm not very computer literate. I just read this.
Yes, there is.
On the internet when I...
Yeah.
It's and is not, that the best way, or well, is there a program that does it for me?
It's not effective, if that's what you
is
mean.
It?
Yeah.
I mean an effective way.
Yeah, you can disable right-click, and I'll put a link in the show notes to an article about how to do that. It's a JavaScript trick.
Okay.
That will disable it. And I've been on sites where you right-click to save a photo and says, sorry, you can't do that. I own it. Go away. But all anybody has to do is disable JavaScript in their browser, and suddenly they can do it.
Yeah.
So it's not effective.
And people are getting really savvy.
Yeah, so this is the issue with copy protection, kind of in a small scale with the overall problem with copy protection, is that copy protection is only effective against... honest people. if somebody's dishonest, they know that, well, I just disabled JavaScript and I've got that picture. If they're honest, they go, oh, I can't get it. But the problem is, right, you don't want to, it's the exact opposite of what you want. You don't want to harm the honest people. You want to slow down the pirates.
Right.
Now, you're putting a watermark in there, so it's not like somebody's going to, and what I would suggest is put lower quality, you know, web quality pictures. They're not going to print an 8x10 out of that.
Right. Like, what DPI should that be?
The DPI for the web should be 72 or 75.
Okay.
And then the resolution should be fairly small. You don't want that picture to be more anyway, just for, you know, because you don't want it to be so big to down that they can't get online. It shouldn't be more than 30 or 40K anyway. At that size, it's not going to be worth it for them. I mean, if they really want a picture, think of it this way. They've got a little ad for you on that picture, Maria. It's got your watermark. They know who took the picture. You want your picture of your pony. Hey, I got it there. Maria took it. That's great. I would let them have it. I would consider that advertising. And then when the time comes that they want a nice big print of it, they're going to come to you.
Right. That's pretty much where I've gone.
I think that's the right way to handle it. I think this is exactly, and it's hard. Look, I create content. I've had my books stolen. You know, it's hard for a content creator. You want to hold on to your stuff. But here's what I would say you have to recognize. First of all, you can't.
Right.
If you want to hold on to it, don't put it on the internet.
I guess I wondered if anybody had come up with some kind of protective
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's lots of, you know, special protective programs. There's some, Digimarc makes one that they can go, if somebody downloads an image of yours, it's Digimarc.com. It's very expensive. If they download a picture of yours, their invisible Digimarc is in there, and they search the net, and they will send them a cease and desist letter so they can't use your images as stock photography, blah, blah, blah. My suggestion is it costs more than it's worth. It's of limited effectiveness. If you're putting stuff on the net, guess what? It's going to get stolen. So the issue is, you know, make sure that they don't have high quality ones and that you consider this promotional. I think it's the only way to deal with it. There are no effective ways, and there never will be, to prevent piracy, period. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number, talking about high tech. I go on and on about this copy protection thing, and I guess I should make a fundamental kind of synopsis of this, which is essentially that bits is bits. Once you put bits out on the internet, it's very, very, very hard, I think impossible, to control them. They will get around. That's their nature. It's like water. It's like nailing Jell-O to a tree. You cannot hold it down. So if you're a content creator and you're putting stuff on the internet, the idea of trying to nail it to a tree, you might as well just give up. It ain't going to happen. In fact, the harder you try, look at the iPhone, look at the Xbox, look at the harder you try, the more likely it is, especially if you have something desirable, the more likely it is people are just going to figure out a way around it. So you end up criminalizing people who are too honest to do that. And you don't in any way thwart piracy. Seems like that's not what you want. So either don't put it on the internet, or figure whatever I put on the internet, that's going to get out there. And live with that. And I think in a case of a photographer, you know, I mean, yeah, you can, there are all sorts of technological tricks you can try, like Digimarc. And I put a link in the show notes to the right click, you know, JavaScript and all that. But really, it's not worth it. I think you should put a copyright notice if you want to maintain the copyright, certainly on the page. You should be pretty clear on the page. Please don't steal my, I would play on the honesty of people. Say, please don't steal my images. You're welcome to download the ones you see here. But if you'd like a full quality copy, I'd love to make a print for you. This is how I make a living. You love my pictures, support me. People respond so much better to that than saying you're a crook and I'm going to try to thwart you. Kevin is in Malibu, California. Hello, Kevin. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, it is great to hear your voice.
Thank you, sir.
And see your picture.
Yes.
Yeah, stick 'em, baby.
Stick 'em, baby. We're going to get you stream up to next show because I know people want to see both my desktop and my smiling face.
I'm putting it on my calendar right now.
Good. What can I do
Leo,
for you?
Our eyesight, the external camera, is just not working.
Oh, dear.
My 14-year-old niece is not happy. And, you know, it doesn't get any worse than that, right?
So it's a FireWire camera. You plug it in, and what happens?
Nothing.
It doesn't. You can't see it. So if you open iChat or you open Skype, it just doesn't show up as on there.
Not only can I not see it, but on the Mac, when I run the system profile, it does not show up in the FireWire.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, can you help me DIY it? I thought maybe I could open it up, see what I can do. I was looking for some tips, instructions. Can you help get us eye chatting with this eyesight?
Well, first thing to do is try another FireWire cable.
I went to the Apple store the other day.
Yeah.
Out here in Thousand Oaks, California.
Yes, sir.
I tried 3 different cables, 5 different machines, and 6 different apps.
And so you took that camera there. No, that's good. You took that camera there and you tried it in all different configurations. It never was seen.
Correct.
All right. So, well, we know the camera's broken. Now, as far as opening up the camera, I don't know.
Well, I got nothing to lose, right?
Right.
Now it's a 3.5-inch aluminum tube.
It's possible that what happened, and I've mentioned this before, because the FireWire is so poorly designed that the plug can be put in backwards, and it just happens that the power line, when you flip it, is just in the right place to fry that chip. So that may have happened to that eyesight. If you have a DV camcorder of any kind, though, you could use that instead.
I do, but remember we're talking 14-year-old niece.
You think she'll break that, too?
Oh, yeah. With a big smile on her face. Uncle Kevin.
You know, the funny thing is Apple doesn't sell this eyesight anymore.
Oh, I learned that at the Apple store.
Yeah.
They not sell it, but their geniuses looked at me like I was from another decade.
Thanks. It's not that old, gang.
So is there anywhere on the web where there's maybe instructions how to do this thing?
Well,
I could not find it.
I don't know. I mean, you can open it up. I don't know what you would fix. If you fried the chip, you're going to be out of luck because you'd have to replace the circuit board in there. And I don't even know where you'd get a replacement circuit board. You'd have to get one from another eyesight.
Well, fortunately, I have my black MacBook here, so I'm not totally without picture. But I want to give her this so she can make her little movies and make it work, you know? Until Apple realizes that they should make this camera so it can turn around in reverse and take pictures in front of it and to the side.
Yeah. How about, now, Shuby's telling me that, and I'm using this right now, the image that you're seeing on Stick'Em is from a Logitech QuickCam 9000, one of the new Pro QuickCams, which are not expensive, about $100. That apparently, it's what you're seeing. Apparently, it works with a Mac. If the Mac doesn't already have a built-in camera on it, it won't work with your laptop, but it would work on the Mac she's been using. I didn't know that. It's a USB camera, but it'll work. Any DV camera will work. Any FireWire camera will work.
That'd be great. Well,
yeah.
I'm on your chat room there, sitting in the back row, trying not to be too snippy.
I'm glad to have you there, Kevin. The other thing you might want to try is go to eBay and see if somebody's selling a used eyesight.
You know, the key is DIY. Want to do it myself?
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, take a look. I don't know exactly what you'd find once you go in there, to be honest with you. It's nowadays, all this stuff is solid state. Not something you can, you know, breadboard together or do anything. I mean, I don't know what you would do with it. But you could, I don't know where to point you in this case. I just, it's not the kind of thing that you can physically fix. I've been very happy with the QuickCam Pro 9000. And it does work with a Mac. Maybe that's the way to go. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. GoToMeeting Web Conferencing, everyone can see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's changing the way we do business. Try it free for 30 days. Go to GoToMeeting.com, click the orange Try It Free button, use my name, Leo, as the promo code. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in Northern California. Let's head down, as we do every week at this time, to Southern California, to Irvine, to be specific. That's where, deep within the hills, he's dug into his bunker. Steve Gibson is secure and safe and protecting us all. Hello, Steve Gibson.
Yes, I've got a little straw poking up from the bunker so I can breathe.
It's the GRC bunker, GRC.com. Steve is a security expert. He's a guy who discovered spyware, coined the term spyware, and has done more than anybody, I think, to protect us, not just from spyware, but from threats of all kinds. And we talk every week about some sort of security issue. What do you want to talk about this week, Steve?
Well, I thought I wanted to make sure that people were aware of the fact that bad guys are really working hard to get stuff and bad stuff installed in their computer.
If that's not apparent yet, it will be. I mean, it's the bane of our existence, frankly, these days.
Yeah, I guess I would characterize malware, that is, you know, software that is malicious or bad for you, in two broad categories. Probably everybody is by now familiar with the problem and threat of spyware being, or adware, something that has gotten into your system that isn't really having your best interests in mind, but sort of has a sort of a slimy commercial tie. That is, there's some company behind it, like Cool Web Search, you know, that is actually incorporated and has some sort of bylaws and is saying, oh, well, you clicked on, yes, please install this in my computer when you went to some website, even though the user is pretty sure they didn't do any such thing. The other category, though, is really a constant problem, and that's really bad guys who have no legitimate commercial interest at all, who are trying to install the so-called Trojans, or bots as they're called, bot being short for robot, because these things are or actually zombie is sort of even more the official term, because these things are controllable remotely. What they're being used for is getting innocent computers, innocent users' computers, to send spam or to attack other people's sites. And the problem is that these services are now for hire, meaning that once upon a time, the people were installing these things in machines just because they could, because they wanted to see how many zombies or how many bots how large a fleet they could collect. However, these fleets are now being leased. They're for sale to spammers who are using people's computers to send out unsolicited commercial email. And the problem is, you can get in trouble with your ISP if they find that your machine is sending out lots of spam.
Yeah, and so it's not so much that they want to vandalize your system these days. In fact, sometimes it's hard to tell that you've been infected, because it's in their interest not to let you know that they're there, right?
That's a very good point. You know, often the older style commercial spyware, it'll add a bar to your browser or some additional features to your desktop saying, oh, look, I've enhanced your system.
Yeah.
But the exact opposite is the case in the case of these zombies or bots or Trojans. They are deliberately designed to be stealthful. You will have no idea that this is installed unless you have some sort of an anti-spyware tool, like a personal firewall, that may raise an alarm saying, hey, something is in your computer that's trying to talk to the internet and you have not given it permission to do so. Or you've got a scanner which has scanned through your machine and found the problem.
Right. So do you have some advice for people to avoid becoming a part of one of these botnets?
Well, the leading source of these problems seems to be file sharing programs, where people are getting software and or music through, you might say, gray channels or black hat channels, where they're getting themselves infected unwittingly, and also going to malicious websites. I would just say practicing safe computing, using an anti-spyware software to keep your machine clean, and just sort of, you know, staying in the brighter lit areas of the internet is probably the best advice I have.
Yeah, this is one of the problems, of course, though, when you have teenagers, is these are the programs they love to use, these file sharing programs.
Yep.
And as soon as a teenager gets on a computer, you could pretty much kiss this goodbye. It's all over.
That's true.
Always great to talk to you, Steve Gibson. He is the security wizard. If you're interested in great detail, if you really want to get nerdy with this stuff and you want to learn how it works, and how crypto works and all that stuff, Steve and I do a weekly hour-long podcast on Thursdays called Security Now. And it's just fascinating stuff. But it's for people who really want to know how this stuff works. It's free. And you can listen on the website, twit.tv, twit.tv. That's my netcast website. We'll also put a link in the show notes so you can get right to it. Steve's site is grc.com. That's where he sells SpinRite, which is really, you've heard me recommend it over and over. It's pretty much the disk maintenance and recovery utility. There's nothing better. There's nothing that can do what SpinRite does. That's more information on that from grc.com or go to SpinRite, SpinRite.info for testimonials. Steve also has a bunch of free programs and services available at his site, grc.com, like Shields Up, which I think many people know about. It's a great way to test your router. and a lot of other software, free stuff. That's great. GRC.com. Steve, great to talk to you. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks, Leo.
Let's get back to the phones. Elizabeth is on the line from San Diego. Hello, Elizabeth. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, I'm working on a Mac iBook G4.
Okay.
And it's a used Mac. It needed some hardware work, so the actual owner got some hardware work on it. And it starts up normally. She was able to use the machine for a little while, and she got some pictures on there and everything. But then one day she booted it up, and it had to go to an account. She never had to log in with an account. So we got into the account, and now it just, when it loads up, it just loads up with a desktop background picture and a cursor. No icons. No, you can't access the hard drive. You can't do anything. So any thoughts, ideas, or should we just do a complete software install on it?
Is there stuff? Well, I mean, the easiest way to fix this, and one of the nice things about the Mac is you can reinstall the operating system without deleting any of your data. So if you have the software disks, that's probably the fastest and easiest way. It is. I'm trying to think of how you could get the screen to look like that. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you could tell it not to show pictures, but I think it'll always show some form of login. So something's wrong. Something's wrong.
Something's wrong because there's no icons. You can't access the hard drive. All you see is a desktop background.
Yeah. My suggestion would be to get the thing up and limping anyway is to put the OS X install disk in. Go ahead and do the install. You'll be able to customize the install. And what you want to do is what's called backup and install, where it takes the old operating system, moves it off into a folder called previous system folder, and puts a whole new operating system on there. All your data is intact. Okay. All your applications are intact. It doesn't change that in any way. See if you can boot then. If you can, my suggestion at that point is to back up your data. Get whatever's on that drive off of it.
Okay.
Because my suspicion is that the drive itself is having trouble. Might not be permanent physical problems. It might just be that it's kind of needs to be formatted. But I would back up your data. Make sure you've got a good copy of it, whether it's backing up to a DVD or a CD or to an external hard drive, but just get it off of there. And when you do it, don't use backup software. Just copy it and make sure it's all intact before you do the next step, which is, I would suggest, running Disk Utility on it and formatting, erasing the drive and starting over and then reinstalling everything. You don't have to do that last step. I would strongly suggest the backup step. If you want, you can just do the backup and keep operating with the thing and wait for something more serious to happen. But it sounds like the hard drive has a little problem on it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, great.
But that's the good news, Elizabeth, about the Mac. It's very easy to replace the operating system without changing anything else. Use that the backup and install feature of the operating system install. Just put your disk in there. A couple of things Apple does right here, because they're not so worried about piracy, frankly. They include a copy of the operating system, a full copy of the operating system, with every computer. I can't believe that you could buy a Windows computer and it doesn't have a copy of Windows on it. That just—I mean, it has it on it, but it doesn't have a restored, you know, a installed disk. That's crazy. Makes me crazy. Yeah, that's just not gonna, you know, that doesn't work. You're going to have a problem. And then secondly, they do make it very easy without formatting the drive or overwriting anything to reinstall the operating system from scratch. I mean, not a restore, but get rid of the old operating system, put it aside, and put a new one in its place. And that really is a good way to recover the system. At that point, you could just boot. This is another option. You could just boot to the operating system disk. So reboot the machine, hold down the C key, pop in the operating system CD, and do that. And that would be another way, if you can't get this up and running, to at least look at your data and get your data off. Sri from Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Sri.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Thanks for calling.
So I'm taking a course at a digital film school, and they teach you how to shoot and also edit. And I really don't want to be a filmmaker. I'm more an artist that just wants to take some of the production into my own hands.
Right.
And the school was, I want to immediately start shooting after that, so I want to buy a camera. And the school recommended Panasonic HVX 200, which is approximately $5,000, and they also say to use Final Cut Pro. A director friend of mine said, no, you should just get a Panasonic DVX 100 and use and edit on iMovie, because he said that Final Cut Pro will just, you'll just get so overwhelmed and depressed.
I'm going to trust that your friend knows you well enough to know what's appropriate.
No, he does actually. He's an acquaintance. He's not enough.
Okay. Eventually, Final Cut is certainly the way pros edit video on a Mac. In fact, that's how movies are made nowadays. It's really a pro tool. But he's right in the sense it's a lot to learn. The old iMovie, not the new iMovie, would be probably enough for most people. The new iMovie is really stripped down.
Gone the other way around.
And you would think, wouldn't you? But no, they decided that it was too hard to use the old iMovie, and they made an even simpler program. And I agree with him that you don't need such an expensive camcorder. Any DV camcorder would be enough to start with. Let me talk a little bit about a model you might want to look at in just a second. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
We got another billboard, Leo.
Carbonite, automatic, secure computer backup over the internet. Try it free at carbonite.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We were talking with Shri. She is getting into video editing. Going to a fancy school, recommended a very fancy camera for her. I'm a little nervous about spending $5,000 on a video camera right now. We are in a big state of change as far as video goes. And I think that this would be a good time to save some money, buy a cheaper camera. It depends on what your needs are. If you're making a movie, okay. Spend some money. Get the Panasonic. Chat room recommended, and I think I agree with him, that for a little bit less, $3,500, you can get the Canon XH-A1, which is an excellent 3CCD high-def camcorder. Really excellent. As you know, I'm kind of a Canon fan. What you're looking for is probably a camera that does 24p. That'll give you a more filmic look. That's 24 frames progressive. And both the Panasonic and the Canon will do that. But I'm wondering if you should really spend that much money right now on a camera, especially if you're going to use iMovie. There's a mismatch there. You know, if your needs are enough that simple enough that iMovie is sufficient for you, you probably don't want to spend that much on a camcorder. I would take a look at, if you want to shoot high def, perhaps the Canon HV20, which is $1,000 and a nice hand. It's a camcorder. It's not a pro or a prosumer recorder. It's a camcorder, but it's high def. And one I'm very attracted to right now, and it shoots in this new format. Now, there's an issue here because the new format is supported by the new iMovie, but not the old iMovie, this new AVC HD format. But I'm very attracted to this new Panasonic, the SD1 or the SD5, because they don't record on tape. They don't record on hard drive. They record on SD, which means it's going to be a lot easier for you to digitize that video. You don't have to wait an hour to get an hour's worth of video into your computer. You just take the card out and you plug it into your computer and it reads it in just a few minutes. The HDC SD1, it's a 3CCD camcorder, not as high quality as the AG that they recommended to you, by no means, but it's only $899. So, you know, it's a fifth the price. It is 3CCDs, but they're smaller. I think that Panasonic they recommended has pretty big, that's what, 1/3-inch CCDs, that's good in low light, that's a good looking, I mean, you're going to get, look, I'm not saying that's a bad camera, it's a great camera. I'm saying, is now the time to spend that much money on a camera? You might be better off waiting. They've announced the Red now is going to be available. They've got an availability date. I think video is in a real state of flux right now, and this might be a good time to buy something less expensive and hang on. I just ordered, and I'll be getting it September 15th when it comes out, the Panasonic HDC SD5, and I'm very intrigued by this camera. It does not do 24p. It is not a progressive scan camera. It's interlaced. So that may be a disadvantage. If you prefer the progressive, you should look at the HV20 or its big brother, which is a hard drive recorder, which is it the HG20? I can't remember. I do like these Panasonics, and I think 3CCDs is nice. That's a nice way to go if you can. Again, it depends on what you're shooting, of course, right? But I just, when I hear somebody say, they told me to spend $5,000 on a camera, hold on. Unless you're making a movie, I don't know if now's the time to do that. Solvio is on the line from Escondido, California. Hello, Solvio.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I have a couple of Mac questions, but also have a kind of an interesting story for you that Microsoft helped me buy my MacBook.
All right. We got about 2 minutes. Okay,
real quick. Yeah, you know these class action lawsuits, sometimes you get these forms and you throw them out. Well, I got one and filled it out. Bought the MacBook, sent them the receipt, and they sent me a check for $653.
Wow. What was the lawsuit?
It was out of a law firm in Minneapolis, and it went back to the 80s. And they, in fact, I'd almost forgotten about it. They'd asked me to fill out a form of what Microsoft software I'd bought over the last 10 years. And
wow.
It was very interesting.
That was part of the states, the settlements of that. The states each got some settlements, and I know California got one. But
yeah, it must have been.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was $600. Wow.
Yeah.
I got the same form. I threw it out.
Oh, you should have filled it out.
I guess so.
Anyways, the quick question I have for you is, first of all, I'm using Boot Camp, and I think it runs Windows better than my Dell machine, which is kind of interesting.
It could if it's later model. I mean, when you run Boot Camp, you're booting Windows. It's a Windows machine.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. In fact, I was even able to put a VPN on there from work. That's kind of, it's a very tricky one, and it works flawlessly.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But the two questions I have for you, over the years in the Windows side, I've been using Acronis True Image and Second Copy.
Okay.
And I was wondering what the equivalent would be or similar product that I could get for the Mac.
For synchronization, there are a number of programs like Folder Sync. I use Super Duper to make images. You actually have an imaging program on the Mac. It's Disk Utility. It will make an image.
Oh, okay.
But if you want to make a bootable image, and this is something you can do on the Mac that you can't do on the PC. Well, maybe you could do, but it's with more trouble on the PC. If you want to make a bootable image, I think Super Duper is a great program. It's free, and if you want some advanced features, you can pay a little bit. Super Duper.
Okay.
And that would be the equivalent of True Image. As far as folder synchronization, boy, there are a lot of choices. Super Duper does a lot of that. You might just look at Super Duper and see if it'll do everything you want.
And would it be possible to create an image of the Boot Camp partition so that way if
yep.
I have to reinstall OS X, it would leave it intact?
That's an interesting question. I think so. It's Windows formatted. That's a really good question. I do not know. I think it will. The Super Duper site should tell you if it can do that. I don't see why not. I mean, it's a partition. The problem is that it's not formatted in an HFS format. So
yeah, I did
a
FAT32.
Yeah, that's a how do you make an image? Well, you could use Acronis on it, of course.
Yeah,
you could just take your True Image and install it on your Mac. Of course, it'd be a little tricky to restore, wouldn't it? You'd have to install Windows
first. Yeah, that's what I would.
First. Boy, you stumped me on that. I'm not sure. If you can back up a Windows partition with Super Duper.
Yeah, because what I'm worried about is Boot Camp keeps reminding me that this is a beta version.
Yeah, oh, don't worry about that. It's very solid. But it's not, it's like any computer. Backing up is a good idea no matter what. I mean, not because of Boot Camp, but just because hard drives fail. Let me look into it, and we'll see if we can find an answer for you and put it on the show notes at techguylabs.com. I'm out of time, though. I will see you next week. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. Well, that's it for The Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear The Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.